Pediatric Advanced Life Support, PALS, provider handbook written by Dr. Carl Disk, narrated by Amazon Polly. The Save a Life Initiative has just released its newest course, Pediatric Advanced Life Support, PALS. This manual is based on the 2020 Pediatric Advanced Life Support Guidelines published by the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation. The Pediatric Advanced Life Support, PALS, Provider Handbook is a comprehensive resource intended for healthcare professionals currently enrolled in a Pediatric Advanced Life Support Certification or Recertification course. It serves as the primary training material for PAL certification and recertification courses. Although it is primarily intended for use during certification courses, the handbook was also created to serve as daily reference material for healthcare professionals. Information covered in the handbook includes EKG and electrical therapy review, pediatric respiratory failure, and more. Specific PALS algorithms and more are also included within the handbook. All material included in this handbook is delivered in a manner meant to enhance learning in the most comprehensive and convenient way possible. This manual is the primary training material for Pediatric Advanced Life Support Certification courses provided by Save a Life Certifications by NHCPS. Chapter 1. Introduction to PALS. The goal of Pediatric Advanced Life Support, PALS, is to save a life. For a child or infant experiencing serious injury or illness, your action can be the difference between life and death. PALS is a series of protocols to guide responses to life-threatening clinical events. These responses are designed to be simple enough to be committed to memory and recalled under moments of stress. PALS guidelines have been developed from thorough review of available protocols, patient case studies, and clinical research, and they reflect the consensus opinion of experts in the field. The gold standard in the United States and many other countries is the course curriculum published by the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation, ILCA. Approximately every 5 years, the ILCA updates the guidelines for cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, and emergency cardiovascular care, ECC. This handbook is based on the most recent ILCA publication of PALS, and will periodically compare the previous and the new recommendations for a more comprehensive review. Proper utilization of PALS requires rapid and accurate assessment of the child or infant's clinical condition and selection and delivery of the appropriate intervention for the given situation. This not only applies to the provider's initial assessment of a child or an infant in distress, but also to the reassessment throughout the course of treatment utilizing PALS guidelines. PALS protocols assume that the provider may not have all of the information needed from the child or the infant or all of the resources needed to properly use PALS in all cases. For example, if a provider is utilizing PALS on the side of the road, they will not have access to sophisticated devices to measure breathing or arterial blood pressure. Nevertheless, in such situations, PALS providers have the framework to provide the best possible care in the given circumstances. PALS algorithms are based on current understanding of best practice to deliver positive results in life-threatening cases and are intended to achieve the best possible outcome for the child or the infant during an emergency. Any provider attempting to perform PALS is assumed to have developed and maintained competence with not only the materials presented in this handbook, but also certain physical skills, including basic life support, BLS, interventions. Since PALS is performed on children and infants, PALS providers should be proficient in BLS for these age groups. While we review the basic concepts of pediatric CPR, providers are encouraged to keep their physical skills in practice and seek additional training if needed. Chapter 2. The Resuscitation Team. The ILCA guidelines for PALS highlights the importance of effective team dynamics during resuscitation. In the community, outside a healthcare facility, the first rescuer on the scene may be performing CPR alone. However, a pediatric arrest event in a hospital may bring dozens of people to the patient's room. It is important to quickly and efficiently organize team members to effectively participate in PALS. The ILCA supports a team structure with each provider assuming a specific role during the resuscitation. This consists of a team leader and several team members. Clear communication between team leaders and team members is essential. It is important to know your own clinical limitations. Resuscitation is the time for implementing acquired skills, not trying new ones. Clearly state when you need help and call for help early in the care of the person. Resuscitation demands mutual respect, knowledge sharing, and constructive criticism. After each resuscitation case, providers should spend time reviewing the process and providing each other with helpful and constructive feedback. Ensuring an attitude of respect and support is crucial and aids in processing the inevitable stress that accompanies pediatric resuscitation. Chapter 3 Basic Life Support. Basic Life Support, BLS, utilizes CPR and cardiac defibrillation when an automated external defibrillator, AED, is available. BLS is the life support method used when there is limited access to advanced interventions such as medications and monitoring devices. In general, BLS is performed until the emergency medical services, EMS, arrives to provide a higher level of care. In every setting, high-quality CPR is the foundation of both BLS and PALS interventions. High-quality CPR gives the child or the infant the greatest chance of survival by providing circulation to the heart, brain, and other organs until return of spontaneous circulation, ROSC. This handbook covers PALS and only briefly describes BLS. All PALS providers are assumed to be able to perform BLS appropriately. It is essential that PALS providers be proficient in BLS first. High-quality BLS is the foundation of PALS. BLS for children, 1 year to puberty. BLS for both children and infants is almost identical. For example, if two rescuers are available to perform CPR, the compression-to-breath ratio is 15:2 for both children and infants. One rescuer BLS for children. If you are alone with a child at the scene, do the following. 1. Tap and talk loudly to the child to determine if they are responsive. 2. If the child does not respond and is not breathing, or only gasping, yell for help. If someone answers, send them to call 911/EMS and to get an AED. 3. Assess for breathing while simultaneously checking for the child's carotid pulse, on the side of the neck, or femoral pulse, on the inner thigh and the crease between their leg and groin, for 5 but no more than 10 seconds. 4. If you cannot feel a pulse or if you are unsure, begin CPR by doing 30 compressions followed by 2 breaths. If you can feel a pulse but the pulse rate is less than 60 beats per minute, you should begin CPR. This rate is too slow for a child. 5. After doing CPR for about 2 minutes, usually about 5 cycles of 30 compressions and 2 breaths, and if other help has not arrived, call EMS while staying with the child. The ILCA emphasizes that cell phones are available everywhere now, and most have a built-in speakerphone. Get an AED if you know where one is. 6. Use and follow AED prompts when available while continuing CPR, until EMS arrives or until the child's condition normalizes. 2. Rescuer BLS for children. If you are not alone with the child at the scene, do the following. 1. Tap and talk loudly at the child to determine if they are responsive. 2. If the child does not respond and is not breathing, or if only gasping, have the second rescuer call 911/EMS and get an AED. The ILCA emphasizes that cell phones are available everywhere now, and most have a built-in speakerphone, so you or the second rescuer can call 911/EMS without leaving the scene. 3. Assess for breathing while simultaneously checking for the child's carotid pulse, on the side of the neck, or femoral pulse, on the inner thigh and the crease between their leg and groin, for 5 but no more than 10 seconds. 4. If you cannot feel a pulse or if you are unsure, begin CPR by doing 15 compressions followed by 2 breaths. If you can feel a pulse but the pulse rate is less than 60 beats per minute, you should begin CPR. This rate is too slow for a child. 5. When the second rescuer returns, begin doing CPR by performing 15 compressions by one rescuer and 2 breaths by the second rescuer. 6. Use and follow AED prompts when available while continuing CPR until EMS arrives or until the child's condition normalizes. BLS for infants, 0 to 12 months. BLS for both children and infants is almost identical. Following are the main differences between BLS for children and BLS for infants. Check the pulse in the infant using the brachial artery on the inside of the upper arm between the infant's elbow and shoulder. During CPR, compressions can be performed on an infant using 2 fingers, if only one rescuer, or with 2 thumb encircling hands, if there are 2 rescuers. And rescuers' hands are big enough to go around the infant's chest. Compression depth should be 1/3 of the chest depth. For most infants, this is about 1.5 inches, 4 centimeters. In infants, primary cardiac events are not common. Usually, cardiac arrest will be preceded by respiratory problems. Survival rates improve when you intervene with respiratory problems as early as possible. Remember that prevention is the first step in the pediatric chain of survival. 1 Rescuer BLS for infants. If you are alone with the infant at the scene, do the following. 1. Tap the heel of their foot and talk loudly at the infant to determine if they are responsive. 2. Assess if they are breathing while simultaneously checking for the infant's brachial pulse for 5, but no more than 10 seconds. If the infant does not respond and is not breathing, only gasping, yell for help. 3. If someone responds, send the second rescuer to call 911/EMS and get an AED. The ILCA emphasizes that cell phones are available everywhere now, and most have a built-in speakerphone, so rescuers do not have to leave the scene. 4. If you cannot feel a pulse or if you are unsure, begin CPR by doing 30 compressions followed by 2 breaths. If you can feel a pulse but the rate is less than 60 beats per minute, begin CPR. This rate is too slow for an infant. To perform CPR on an infant, do the following. A. Be sure the infant is face up on a hard surface. B. Using 2 fingers, perform compressions in the center of the infant's chest. Do not press on the end of the sternum as this can cause injury to the infant. C. Compression depth should be about 1.5 inches, 4 centimeters, and 100 to 120 compressions per minute. 5. Perform CPR for about 2 minutes, using 5 cycles of 30 compressions and 2 breaths. If help has not arrived, call 911/EMS and get an AED. 6. Use and follow AED prompts when available while continuing CPR, until EMS arrives or until the infant's condition normalizes. 2 Rescuer BLS for infants. If you are not alone with the infant at the scene, do the following. 1. Tap the bottom of their foot and talk loudly at the infant to determine if they are responsive. 2. If the infant does not respond, have the second rescuer call 911/EMS and get an AED. The ILCA emphasizes that cell phones are available everywhere now, and most have a built-in speakerphone, so you can call while at the scene. 3. Assess if they are breathing while simultaneously feeling for the infant's brachial pulse for 5, but no more than 10 seconds. 4. If you cannot feel a pulse or if you are unsure, begin CPR by doing 15 compressions followed by 2 breaths. If you can feel a pulse but the rate is less than 60 beats per minute, begin CPR. This rate is too slow for an infant. 5. When the second rescuer returns, begin CPR by performing 15 compressions by one rescuer and 2 breaths by the second rescuer. If the second rescuer can fit their hands around the infant's chest, perform CPR using the two-thumb encircling hands method. Do not press on the bottom end of the sternum, as this can cause injury to the infant. 6. Compressions should be approximately 1.5 inches, 4 centimeters, deep and at a rate of at least 100 to 120 per minute. 7. Use and follow AED prompts when available while continuing CPR, until EMS arrives or until the infant's condition normalizes. Self-assessment for BLS. 1. You respond to a child or an infant that is found down. What is the next action after? Determining unresponsiveness. A. Apply AED. B. Tell a bystander to call 911. C. Look for a parent. D. Provide rescue breaths. 2. Which of the following describes the brachial pulse location? A. Wrist, thumb side. B. Elbow, inside near forearm. C. Upper arm, inside. D. Neck, either side of the trachea. 3. What is the two rescuer CPR compression to breath ratio for children and infants? A. 30 to 2. B. 15 to 2. C. 30 to 5. D. 15 to 5. 4. Effective communication is key in all resuscitation attempts. Which of the following are components of effective team communication? A. Knowledge sharing. B. Clear communication. C. Mutual respect. D. All of the above. Answers. 1. B. Early activation is key. Send any available bystanders to call 911. Many pediatric cardiac arrest situations are the result of a respiratory problem, and immediate intervention can be life-saving. 2. C. The brachial pulse is located in the upper arm. 3. B. For children and infants, 15 to 2 is the ratio for two rescuers, and 30 to 2 is the ratio for one rescuer. 4. D. Additional components include clear messages, knowing one's limitations constructive. Intervention, reevaluation, and summarizing. Chapter 4. Pediatric Advanced Life Support. Normal heart anatomy and physiology. Understanding normal cardiac anatomy and physiology is an important component of performing PALS. The heart is a hollow muscle comprised of four chambers surrounded by thick walls of tissue, septum. The atria are the two upper chambers, and the ventricles are the two lower chambers. The left and right halves of the heart work together to pump blood throughout the body. The right atrium, RA, and the right ventricle, RV, pump deoxygenated blood to the lungs where it becomes oxygenated. This oxygen-rich blood returns to the left atrium, LA, and then enters the left ventricle, LV. The LV is the main pump that delivers the newly oxygenated blood to the rest of the body. Blood leaves the heart through a large vessel known as the aorta. Valves between each pair of connected chambers prevent the backflow of blood. The two atria contract simultaneously, as do the ventricles, making the contractions of the heart go from top to bottom. Each beat begins in the RA. The LV is the largest and thickest walled of the four chambers, as it is responsible for pumping the newly oxygenated blood to the rest of the body. The sinoatrial, SA, node in the RA creates the electrical activity that acts as the heart's natural pacemaker. This electrical impulse then travels to the atrioventricular, AV, node, which lies between the atria and ventricles. After pausing there briefly, the electrical impulse moves on to the His-Purkinje system, which acts like wiring to conduct the electrical signal into the LV and RV. This electrical signal causes the heart muscle to contract and pump blood. By understanding the normal electrical function of the heart, it will be easy to understand abnormal functions. When blood enters the atria of the heart, an electrical impulse that is sent out from the SA node conducts through the atria, resulting in atrial contraction. This atrial contraction registers on an electrocardiogram, ECG, stripped as the P wave. This impulse then travels to the AV node, which in turn conducts the electrical impulse through the bundle of His, bundle branches and Purkinje fibers of the ventricles, causing ventricular contraction. The time between the start of atrial contraction and the start of ventricular contraction registers on an EC strip as the PR interval. The ventricular contraction registers on the ECG strip as the QRS complex. Following ventricular contraction, the ventricles rest and repolarize, which is registered on the ECG strip as the T wave. The atria also repolarize, but this coincides with the QRS complex and therefore cannot be observed on the ECG strip. Together, a P wave, QRS complex, and T wave at proper intervals are indicative of normal sinus rhythm, NSR. Abnormalities that are in the conduction system can cause delays in the transmission of the electrical impulse and are detected on the ECG. These deviations from normal conduction can result in dysrhythmias, such as heart blocks, pauses, tachycardias and bradycardias, blocks, and drop beats. These rhythm disturbances will be covered in more detail further in the handbook. A systematic approach. When you find an unresponsive child or infant, it is often not possible to immediately deduce the etiology. You will want to act quickly, decisively, and apply interventions that fit the needs of the individual at that moment. In order to achieve this, PALS was designed for providers to take a comprehensive approach. While there are various causes for a child or an infant to become unresponsive, the central issues that need to be addressed include keeping blood pumping through the vasculature, perfusion, and supplying oxygen to the lungs, oxygenation. When the child or infant is experiencing poor perfusion and oxygenation, CPR manually takes over for the heart and lungs. If they are still adequately maintaining perfusion and oxygenation but are unresponsive, then rapid diagnosis and treatment may be possible without CPR. It is important to differentiate normal breathing from gasping, agonal breathing. Gasping is considered ineffective breathing. Likewise, not all pulses are adequate. The rule of thumb is that at least 60 beats per minute is required to maintain adequate perfusion in a child or an infant. The assessment must be carried out quickly. There is a low threshold for administering ventilation and/or compressions if there is evidence that the child or infant cannot do either effectively on their own. If the problem is respiratory in nature, ineffective breathing with adequate pulses, then initiation of rescue breathing is warranted. If breathing is ineffective and pulses are inadequate, begin high-quality CPR immediately. It is important to understand that any case can change at any time, so you must reevaluate periodically and adjust the approach to treatment accordingly. Use CPR to support breathing and circulation until the cause has been identified and effectively treated. Initial diagnosis and treatment. If you have reached the initial diagnosis and treatment phase of care, the child or infant is not in immediate danger of death. While this means that you likely have a brief period to find the cause of the problem and intervene with appropriate treatment, it does not mean that a life-threatening event is impossible. Always be vigilant for any indication to initiate high-quality CPR and look for life-threatening events such as respiratory distress, a change in consciousness, or cyanosis. Circulation. Assessment of circulation in pediatrics involves more than checking the pulse and blood pressure. The color and temperature of the skin and mucous membranes can help to assess effective circulation. Pale or blue skin indicates poor tissue perfusion. Capillary refill time is also a useful assessment in pediatrics. Adequately perfused skin will rapidly refill with blood after it is squeezed, for example by bending the tip of the finger at the nail bed. Inadequately perfused tissues will take longer than 2 seconds to respond. Abnormally cool skin can also suggest poor circulation. The normal heart rate and blood pressure in pediatrics are quite different than in adults, and change with age. Likewise, heart rates are slower when children and infants are asleep. Most centers will have acceptable ranges that they use for normal and abnormal heart rates for a given age. Disability. In PALS, disability refers to performing a rapid neurological assessment. A great deal of information can be gained from determining the level of consciousness on a 4-level scale. Pupillary response to light is also a fast and useful way to assess neurological function. Neurologic assessments include the AVPU, alert, voice, pain, unresponsive, response scale and the Glasgow Coma Scale, GCS. A specially modified GCS is used for children and infants and takes developmental differences into account. Exposure. Exposure is classically most important when you are responding to a child or infant who may have experienced trauma. However, it has a place in all PALS evaluations. Exposure reminds the provider to look for signs of trauma, burns, fractures, and any other obvious sign that might provide a clue as to the cause of the current problem. Skin temperature and color can provide information about the child or infant's cardiovascular system, tissue perfusion, and mechanism of injury. If time allows, the PALS provider can look for more subtle signs such as petechiae or bruising. Exposure also reminds the provider that children and infants lose core body temperature faster than adults do. Therefore, while it is important to evaluate the entire body, be sure to cover and warm the individual after the diagnostic survey. Secondary diagnosis and treatment. After you have progressed through the APT method and have discovered a treatable cause, and the child or infant has not deteriorated to a more severe clinical, life-threatening situation, move on to performing a more thorough survey. This includes a focused history and physical examination involving the individual, family, and any witnesses as relevant. In terms of history, you could follow the acronym SPAM, signs and symptoms, past medical history, allergies, and medications. The focused examination will be guided by the answers to the focused history. For example, a report of difficult breathing will prompt a thorough airway and lung examination. It may also prompt a portable chest X-ray study in a hospital setting. Key point is that it is best to work from head to toe to complete a comprehensive survey. Make use of diagnostic tools when possible to augment the physical examination. Life-threatening issues. If at any time you determine that the child or infant is experiencing a life-threatening emergency, support breathing and cardiovascular function immediately. This usually means providing high-quality CPR. While it is important to recognize and respond to the particular cause of the problem, the time required to determine the problem should not interfere with perfusion and oxygenation for the child or the infant. As you maintain breathing and circulation for them, determine if they are primarily experiencing respiratory distress/arrest, bradycardia, tachycardia, shock, or cardiac arrest. Individual PALS protocols for each of these clinical situations are provided throughout this handbook. Self-assessment for PALS. 1. What is a simple mnemonic for aid in the assessment of mental status? A. AVPU. B. Sample. C. APT. D. NLP. 2. You are resuscitating a child and your partner suggests to follow SPAM. What is this acronym related to? A. Primary survey, initial diagnosis and treatment. B. CPR technique. C. Secondary survey, secondary diagnosis and treatment. D. Medications to consider. 3. True or false, the Glasgow Coma Scale, GSC, verbal component utilizes the exact same responses for infants and adults. Answers. 1. A. AVPU, alert, voice, pain, unresponsive, is a simple assessment tool to assess for adequate brain perfusion. 2. C. SPAM stands for signs and symptoms, past medical history, allergies, medications. SPAN refers to the history component of the more comprehensive secondary survey, secondary diagnosis and treatment. 3. False. The GSC is modified for children and infants. The verbal abilities of an infant are much different from those of a child or adult. Chapter 5. Resuscitation tools. Understanding that resuscitation tools are available is an essential component of PALS. These adjuncts are broken down into two subcategories, medical devices and pharmacological tools. A medical device is an instrument used to diagnose, treat, or facilitate care. Pharmacological tools are the medications used to treat the common challenges experienced during a pediatric emergency. It is important that a thorough understanding is achieved to optimally care for a child or an infant that needs assistance. Intraosseous access should not be attempted without training. Medical devices. Intraosseous access. The relative softness of bones in young children makes intraosseous access a quick, useful means to administer fluids and medications in emergency situations when intravenous access cannot be performed quickly or efficiently. Fortunately, any medication that can be given through a vein can be administered into the bone marrow without dose adjustment. Contraindications include bone fracture, history of bony malformation, and insertion site infection. Bag mask ventilation. When performed appropriately, bag mask ventilation is an important intervention in PALS. Proper use requires proper fit. The child or the infant's mouth and nose should be covered tightly, but not the eyes. When possible, use a clear mask since it will allow you to see the color of their lips and the presence of condensation in the mask indicating exhalation. The two most common types of bag masks are self-inflating and flow-inflating. While a self-inflating bag mask should be the first choice in resuscitations, it should not be used in children or infants who are breathing spontaneously. Flow-inflating bag masks, on the other hand, require more training and experience to operate properly, as the provider must simultaneously manage gas flow, suitable mask seal, individual's neck position, and proper tidal volume. The minimum size bag should be 450 milliliters for infants and young and or small children. Older children may require a 1000 milliliters volume bag. Proper ventilation is of utmost importance as insufficient ventilation leads to respiratory acidosis. Endotracheal intubation. Endotracheal, ET, intubation is used when the airway cannot be maintained when bag mask. Ventilation is inadequate or ineffective, or when a definitive airway is necessary. ET intubation requires specialized training and a complete description is beyond the scope of this handbook. Basic airway adjuncts. Oropharyngeal airway. The oropharyngeal airway, OPA, is a J-shaped device that fits over the tongue to hold the soft hypopharyngeal structures and the tongue away from the posterior wall of the pharynx. OPA is used in persons who are at risk of developing airway obstruction from the tongue or from relaxed upper airway muscles. If efforts to open the airway fail to provide and maintain a clear, unobstructed airway, then use the OPA in unconscious persons. An OPA should not be used in a conscious or semi-conscious person because it can stimulate gagging and vomiting. The key assessment is to check whether the person has an intact cough and gag reflex. If so, do not use an OPA. Nasopharyngeal airway. The nasopharyngeal airway, NPA, is a soft rubber or plastic uncuffed tube that provides a conduit for airflow between the nares and the pharynx. It is used as an alternative to an OPA in persons who need a basic airway management adjunct. Unlike the oral airway, NPAs may be used in conscious or semi-conscious persons, persons with intact cough and gag reflex. The NPA is indicated when the insertion of an OPA is technically difficult or dangerous. Use caution or avoid placing NPAs in a person with obvious facial fractures. Suctioning. Suctioning is an essential component of maintaining a patent airway. Providers should suction the airway immediately if there are copious secretions, blood, or vomit. Attempts at suctioning should not exceed 10 seconds. To avoid hypoxemia, follow suctioning attempts with a short period of 100% oxygen administration. Monitor the person's heart rate, pulse oxygen saturation, and clinical appearance during suctioning. If a change in monitoring parameters is seen, interrupt suctioning and administer oxygen until the heart rate returns to normal and until the clinical condition improves. Assist ventilation as warranted. Only use an OPA in unresponsive persons with no cough or gag reflex. Otherwise, OPA can stimulate vomiting, aspiration, and laryngeal spasm. An NPA can be used in conscious persons with intact cough and gag reflex. However, use carefully in persons with facial trauma because of the risk of displacement. Keep in mind that the person is not receiving 100% oxygen while suctioning. Interrupt suctioning and administer oxygen if any change in monitoring parameters is observed during suctioning. Basic airway technique. Inserting an OPA. Step 1. Clear the mouth of blood and secretions with suction if possible. Step 2. Select an airway device that is the correct size for the person. Too large of an airway device can damage the throat. Too small of an airway device can press the tongue into the airway. Step 3. Place the device at the side of the person's face. Choose the device that extends from the corner of the mouth to the earlobe. Step 4. Insert the device into the mouth so the point is toward the roof of the mouth or parallel to the teeth. Do not press the tongue back into the throat. Step 5. Once the device is almost fully inserted, turn it until the tongue is cupped by the interior curve of the device. Inserting an NPA. Step 1. Select an airway device that is the correct size for the person. Step 2. Place the device at the side of the person's face. Choose the device that extends from the tip of the nose to the earlobe. Use the largest diameter device that will fit. Step 3. Lubricate the airway with a water-soluble lubricant or anesthetic jelly. Step 4. Insert the device slowly, moving straight into the face, not toward the brain. Step 5. It should feel snug. Do not force the device into the nostril. If it feels stuck, remove it and try the other nostril. Tips on suctioning. When suctioning the oropharynx, do not insert the catheter too deeply. Extend the catheter to the maximum safe depth and suction as you withdraw. When suctioning an ET tube, remember the tube is within the trachea and you may be suctioning near the bronchi/lung. Therefore, a sterile technique should be used. Each suction attempt should be for no longer than 10 seconds. Remember, the person will not get oxygen during suctioning. Monitor vital signs during suctioning and stop suctioning immediately if the person experiences hypoxemia, oxygen sats less than 94%, has a new arrhythmia, or becomes cyanotic. OPAs too large or too small may obstruct the airway. NPAs sized incorrectly may enter the esophagus. Always check for spontaneous respirations after insertion of either device. Automated external defibrillator. If you look around the public places you visit, you are likely to find an automated external defibrillator, AED. An AED is both sophisticated and easy to use, providing life-saving power in a user-friendly device. This makes the device useful for people who have no experience operating an AED and allows for successful use in stressful scenarios. However, proper use of an AED is very important. The purpose of defibrillation is to reset the electrical systems of the heart, allowing a normal rhythm a chance to return. Criteria for AED use. No response after shaking and shouting. Not breathing or ineffective breathing. No carotid artery pulse detected. AED steps for children and infants. 1. Retrieve the AED. A. Open the case. B. Turn on the AED. 2. Expose the person's chest. A. If wet, dry the chest. B. Remove any medication patches.
3.
Open the pediatric AED pads. A. Peel off backing. B. Check for pacemaker or implanted defibrillator. 4. Apply the pads. A. Apply one pad on the upper right chest above the breast. For infants, apply in front of the chest. B. Apply the second pad on the lower left chest below the armpit. For infants, apply a second pad to the back. 5. Ensure wires are attached to the AED box. 6. Move away from the child. A. Stop CPR. B. Instruct others not to touch the person. 7. Let AED analyze the rhythm. 8. If the message reads check electrodes, then A. Ensure electrodes make good contact. B. If the message reads shock, then shock. 9. Resume CPR for 2 minutes. 10. Repeat cycle. If the AED is not working properly, continue giving CPR. Do not waste excessive time troubleshooting the AED. CPR always comes first. AEDs are supplemental. Do not use AED in water. Pharmacological tools. Use of any of the medications listed should be done within your scope of practice and after a thorough study of the actions and side effects. This provides only a brief reminder for those who are already knowledgeable in the use of these medications. Moreover, it contains only pediatric doses, indications and routes of administration, intravenous/intraosseous, for the most common PALS drugs. Although cited for reference, routine administration of drugs via an ET tube is discouraged. Rapid access and drug delivery through an IO are preferred to ET administration, as drug absorption from the ET tube route is unpredictable. Adenosine supraventricular tachycardia. First dose, 0.1 mg/kg. Max dose, 6 mg. Second dose, 0.2 mg/kg. Max dose, 12 mg. Rapid fall/IO bolus, no ET flush with saline. Monitor ECG. Amiodarone tachyarrhythmia. 5 mg/kg over 20 to 60 minutes. Very long half-life. Monitor ECG and BP. Atropine bradycardia. 0.02 mg/kg. ET 0.03 mg/kg. Repeat once if needed. Max single dose half a milligram. Also used to treat specific toxins, for example organophosphate. Poisoning. Epinephrine cardiac arrest slash shock. 4/IO, 0.01 mg/kg, 1:10,000 max dose 1 mg ET, 0.1 mg/kg, 1:1000 max dose 2.5 mg. Multiple uses, multiple routes. Repeat every 3 to 5 minutes if needed. Glucose hypoglycemia 0.5 to 1 g/kg. Newborn, 5 to 10 ml/kg, D10W. Infant/children, 2 to 4 ml/kg, D25W. Adolescents, 1 to 2 ml/kg, D50W. Lidocaine tachyarrhythmia. Initial, 1 mg/kg. Infusion, 20 to 50 micrograms/kg per minute. Max dose 100 mg ET 2 to 3 mg. Magnesium sulfate torsade de pointe/refractory asthma. 20 to 50 mg/kg over 10 to 20 minutes. Max dose 2 grams. May run faster for torsade. Milrinone cardiogenic shock. Initial 50 micrograms/kg over 10 to 60 minutes. Maintain 0.5 to 0.75 micrograms/kg per minute. Longer infusion times and euvolemia will reduce the risk of hypotension. Naloxone opioid reversal. Less than 5 years/0 or under 20 kilograms. 0.1 milligrams/kg. Over 5 years/0 or over 20 kilograms, 2 milligrams 4Q. 2 to 3 minutes PRN. Decrease dose to reverse respiratory. Depression due to therapeutic opioid. Use 1 to 5 micrograms/kg, titrate to effect. Procainamide tachyarrhythmia. 15 mg/kg over 30 to 60 minutes. Do not give with amiodarone, monitor ECG and BP. Sodium bicarbonate metabolic acidosis. Hyperkalemia. 1 mEq/kg slow bolus. Max dose 50 mEq. Monitor ABG and ECG after adequate ventilation. Self-assessment for resuscitation tools. 1. What is the proper sequence for AED operation? A. Apply pads, turn on AED, deliver the shock, and clear the individual. B. Apply pads, clear individual, deliver shock, and analyze the rhythm. C. Turn on AED, apply pads, deliver the shock, and resume CPR. D. Turn on AED, analyze rhythm, CPR, and deliver the shock. 2. You are treating a 10-year-old with a rapid pulse. The monitor is showing supraventricular tachycardia, SVT. What drug do you consider to treat this person? A. Vasopressin. B. Lidocaine. C. Brintellum. D. Adenosine. 3. Which of the following explains why ET delivery of drugs is not the preferred route? A. Unpredictable absorption. B. Allergic reaction. C. Difficult administration. D. High effectiveness. Answers. 1. C. AE devices are equipped with instructions and may also have voice prompts, making these devices operable by everyone. 2. D. Adenosine is effective for the treatment of SET. The first dose is 0.1 mg/kg up to a maximum of 6 mg. The second dose is 0.2 mg/kg up to a maximum of 12 mg. 3. A. Delivery of medications via the ET tube results in unpredictable absorption. The intravenous or intraosseous route is preferred. Chapter 6. Respiratory distress/failure. Recognizing respiratory distress/failure. In its simplest form, respiratory distress is a condition in which pulmonary activity is insufficient to bring oxygen to and remove carbon dioxide from the blood. The challenge arises with the recognition of respiratory distress when the person appears to be breathing, but is not actually breathing effectively. Proper rate and depth of breathing are important to assess when evaluating whether the person is effectively breathing. The two main actions involved in breathing are ventilation and oxygenation. Consider the signs and symptoms presented below. Causes of respiratory distress/failure. Respiratory distress or failure generally falls into one of four broad categories: upper airway, lower airway, lung tissue disease, and central nervous system, CNS, issues. This list is not comprehensive, and specific conditions should be addressed with specific therapy, but these represent the most common causes of respiratory distress or failure in a pediatric population. In some instances, breath sounds can provide information about the source of the breathing problem. Responding to respiratory distress/failure. PALS management of respiratory distress/failure is adjusted based on the severity of the current condition. For example, mild asthma is treated with bronchodilator inhalers, but severe asthma, status asthmaticus, may require ET intubation. The provider must continually assess the person's current needs and adjust care accordingly. As an example, croup management depends on the severity of the disease. Dexamethasone, a corticosteroid, can cause hypertension and reduce the activation of lymphocytes. In general, providers commonly work from the least to the most invasive intervention, top to bottom. If the person presents with severe distress, proceed directly to maneuvers that are more aggressive. Albuterol is the most common medication used via nebulizer to cause bronchodilation. Common causes of acute community-acquired pneumonia include Streptococcus pneumonia, Mycoplasma pneumonia, Haemophilus influenza, and Chlamydia pneumonia. High fever is the most common cause of quiet tachypnea. Self-assessment for respiratory distress/failure. 1. Which of the following sounds suggest an upper airway obstruction? A. Stridor. B. Burping. C. Rails. D. Apnea. 2. A 5-year-old child is laughing and playing with his siblings. Moments later, the child was noted to be coughing with asymmetric chest rise. What is the most likely cause? A. Trauma. B. Airway obstruction. C. Stroke. D. Pericardial tamponade. 3. A 4-month-old female infant is noted to be febrile and grunting. What underlying problem does grunting suggest? A. Behavior problem. B. Upper airway obstruction. C. Lung tissue diseased. Diabetes. Answers. 1. A. Stridor suggests an upper airway source of obstruction. 2. B. Asymmetric chest rise in this setting is most likely a foreign body obstructing the right. Mainstem bronchus. Other causes include pneumothorax, hemothorax, pleural effusion, and mucus plugging. 3. C. Grunting is a sign of lung tissue abnormalities, such as pneumonia or pulmonary contusion, and acute respiratory distress and may progress to respiratory failure. Chapter 7. Bradycardia. Recognizing bradycardia. Bradycardia is defined as a heart rate that is slower than what is considered normal for a child's age. Bradycardia in children and infants should be evaluated, but not all bradycardia needs to be medically managed. Intervention is required when bradycardia is symptomatic and compromises cardiovascular function. This commonly means that the heart is beating too slowly to maintain blood pressure, thereby causing shock, poor tissue perfusion, and or a change in mental status. Symptomatic bradycardia may cause a number of signs and symptoms including low blood pressure, pulmonary edema / congestion, abnormal rhythm, chest discomfort, shortness of breath, lightheadedness, confusion, and or syncope. Bradycardia most commonly becomes symptomatic when it is of new onset for the person, acute slowing of the heart rate. Sinus bradycardia. Normal rhythm with slow rate. First degree AV block. PR interval is longer than 0.20 seconds. Type 1, second degree AV block, Mobitz-1/Wenckebach, PR interval increases in length until QRS complex is dropped. Type 2, second degree AV block, Mobitz-2, PR interval is the same length with an intermittently dropped QRS complex. Third degree AV block, complete, PR interval and QRS complex are not coordinated with each other. Responding to bradycardia. Check heart rate, confirm abnormally low heart rate or a significant rate drop from previous normal. PAL survey. A. Airway. B. Breathing, check O2 sats, administer O2 as needed. C. Circulation, check blood pressure and rate, 12-lead ECG, IV/IO access. D. Disability, check neuro status. E. Exposure, check for signs of trauma, burns, fractures, etc. Check for signs/symptoms. Are there symptoms of shock or acute change in mental status? Are there symptoms being caused by the bradycardia? Bradycardia symptomatic and serious. Do not delay CPR. Epinephrine 0.01 mg per kilogram IO or IV can be given every 3 to 5 minutes. Atropine 0.02 mg per kilogram IO or IV can be repeated once. Drugs unsuccessful. Consider transthoracic/transvenous pacing, preferably with sedation, especially if bradycardia is the result of a complete heart block or an abnormal sinus node function. Seek expert consultation. The primary goal of symptomatic bradycardia treatment is to make sure the heart is adequately pumping blood to the body, adequate perfusion. Treatment is not necessarily aimed at increasing the heart rate. Treatment should continue until symptoms/signs resolve. If the person stops having a pulse, move to the cardiac arrest protocol. Always consider the reversible causes of bradycardia in pediatrics and treat if possible. Atropine in doses less than 0.1 mg may worsen bradycardia, paradoxical bradycardia. Self-assessment for bradycardia. 1. You are treating a child with a toxin ingestion, resulting in bradycardia. Atropine is advised by poison control. Why is the minimum dose 0.1 mg IV? A. Rebound tachycardia. B. May worsen bradycardia. C. Apnea. D. Cardiac arrest. 2. What is the drug of choice in managing symptomatic bradycardia? A. Adenosine. B. Epinephrine. C. Lidocaine. D. Dopamine. 3. Your team is treating a child with symptomatic bradycardia. His heart rate is 22 BPM, and you are having difficulty obtaining blood pressure. Epinephrine and atropine have had no effect. What would be the next most appropriate action? A. Faster CPR. B. Transthoracic pacing. C. High-dose epinephrine. D. Terminate resuscitation. Answers. 1. B. A dose less than 0.1 mg may worsen the bradycardia. The maximum dose for a child is 0.5 mg. 2. B. Epinephrine is a potent vasopressor and will also increase heart rate. The dose for bradycardia is 0.01 mg per kilogram IV or IO. 3. B. Transthoracic pacing is an option for treatment of symptomatic bradycardia when drug therapy fails. Chapter 8. Tachycardia. Recognizing tachycardia. Tachycardia is defined as a heart rate greater than what is considered normal for a child's age. Like bradycardia, tachycardia can be life-threatening if it compromises the heart's ability to perfuse effectively. When the heart beats too quickly, there is a shortened relaxation phase. This causes two main problems. The ventricles are unable to fill completely, so cardiac output is lowered, and the coronary arteries receive less blood, so supply to the heart is decreased. There are several kinds of tachycardia, and they can be difficult to differentiate in children on ECG due to the elevated heart rate. Signs and symptoms of tachycardia. Respiratory distress/failure. Poor tissue perfusion, for example low urine output, altered mental state. Pulmonary edema/congestion. Weak, rapid pulse. Sinus tachycardia. Normal rhythm with fast rate. Likely non-dangerous. Commonly occurring during stress or fever. Supraventricular tachycardia. Rhythm starts above the ventricles. Atrial fibrillation. Causes irregular heart rhythm. Atrial flutter. Causes a sawtooth pattern on ECG. Ventricular tachycardia. Rhythm starts in the ventricles. Pediatric tachyarrhythmias are first divided into narrow complex or wide complex tachycardia. Measure the QRS complex on a standard ECG to assess its width. Narrow QRS complex. Atrial flutter is an uncommon rhythm distinguished on an ECG as a sawtooth pattern. It is caused by an abnormal pathway that causes the atria to beat very quickly and ineffectively. Atrial contractions may exceed 300 BPM, but not all of these will reach the AV node and cause a ventricular contraction. Most often, PALS providers will have to distinguish between two similar narrow QRS complex. Tachyarrhythmias, sinus tachycardia and supraventricular tachycardia, SVT. SVT is more commonly caused by accessory pathway reentry, AV node reentry, and ectopic atrial focus. Wide QRS complex. Ventricular tachycardia, VT, is uncommon in children, but can be rapidly fatal. Unless the person has a documented wide complex tachyarrhythmia, an ECG with a QRS complex greater than 0.09 seconds is VT until proven otherwise. Polymorphic VT, torsade de pointe, and unusual SVT, SVT, with wide complexes due to aberrant conduction, may be reversible, for example magnesium for torsade, but do not delay treatment for VT. Any of these rhythms can devolve into ventricular fibrillation, VF. VT may not be particularly rapid, simply greater than 120 BPM, but is regular. Generally, P waves are lost during VT or become dissociated from the QRS complex. Fusion beats are a sign of VT and are produced when both the supraventricular and ventricular impulse combine to produce a hybrid appearing QRS fusion beat. Self-assessment for tachycardia. 1. Which of the following is not a life-threatening arrhythmia? A. Torsade de pointe. B. Ventricular fibrillation. C. Ventricular tachycardia. D. Sinus tachycardia. 2. You are treating a 13-year-old male who has a history of congenital heart disease. The monitor shows a narrow complex rhythm with a heart rate of 175 BPM, and he has a palpable pulse. Which of the following is a possible diagnosis? A. SVT with aberrancy. B. Sinus tachycardia. C. Torsade de pointe. D. Ventricular tachycardia. 3. You are treating a 10-year-old child who has SVT. What is the appropriate first dose for adenosine? A 1 milligram. B 6 milligrams. C 0.1 milligram per kilogram with a maximum dose of 6 milligrams. D 12 milligrams. Answers. 1. D. Sinus tachycardia is often a response to an underlying condition such as fever, pain, or stress. Blood loss and hypovolemia can also result in sinus tachycardia, but the rhythm itself is not life-threatening. 2. B. Sinus tachycardia, atrial fibrillation or flutter, and supraventricular tachycardia are narrow complex rhythms. 3. C. Pediatric drug doses are based on weight. The maximum first dose is 6 mg for both adults and children. Chapter 9. Recognizing shock. Shock is defined as a condition in which peripheral tissues and end organs do not receive adequate oxygen and nutrients. While it is sometimes used interchangeably with severe hypotension, shock does not only occur in the setting of severely low blood pressure. Importantly, the body will attempt to compensate for shock through various mechanisms, most commonly through increased heart rate. The heart rate will increase in an attempt to increase cardiac output, stroke volume 10 heart rate. Blood flow will be shunted from less vital organs, such as the skin, to more vital organs, such as the kidneys and the brain. In these cases, the child or the infant may be experiencing shock, but have high normal or low normal blood pressure. This is called compensatory shock and may only persist for minutes to hours before progressing to frank uncompensated shock unless treatment is initiated. Without treatment, these compensatory systems can become overwhelmed and result in the child progressing quickly to critical hypotension and cardiac arrest. Therefore, the simple assessment of blood pressure is not a sufficient way to evaluate potential shock in pediatrics. Hypovolemic shock. Hypovolemic shock is the most common type of shock and perhaps the easiest to understand. Hypovolemic shock results from insufficient blood in the cardiovascular system. This can be due to hemorrhage externally or into the peritoneum or into the gastrointestinal system. Hypovolemic shock in children can also occur from water loss, perspiration, diarrhea, vomiting, or when fluid moves into the tissues, third spacing. In hypovolemic shock, preload to the heart is decreased, less volume to fill the heart, though contractility is normal or increased. Likewise, afterload is increased since the vessels have constricted in an attempt to increase blood pressure. Distributive shock. Distributive shock is a condition in which the majority of blood is inappropriately distributed in the vasculature. A common way to conceptualize distributive shock is as a condition in which the vasculature has relaxed and dilated to the point of inadequacy. The arterial blood supply needs to maintain a certain tension in order to maintain blood pressure. Likewise, the venous system must maintain tension as well, so as not to retain too much of the total blood supply. In distributive shock, the blood is not being maintained in the required and needed useful blood vessels. Distributive shock is most commonly caused by sepsis, anaphylaxis, or a neurological problem, all of which cause vascular dilation or loss of blood vessel tone. In distributive shock, the preload, contractility, and afterload vary depending on the etiology. Distributive shock is difficult to recognize because the signs and symptoms vary greatly depending on the etiology. Common symptoms include tachypnea, tachycardia, low to normal blood pressure, decreased urine output, and decreased level of consciousness. Distributive shock is further categorized into warm and cold shock. If the person is experiencing warm shock, they commonly will have warm, erythematous peripheral skin, and a wide pulse pressure in the setting of hypotension. If the person is experiencing cold shock, they commonly will have pale, vasoconstrictive skin and narrow pulse pressure hypotension. In each case, distributive shock is generally considered when the person is likely to have one of the three main causes, sepsis, anaphylaxis, or neurological problem. Cardiogenic shock. Cardiogenic shock is caused by inadequate contractility of the heart. One of the key differences between hypovolemic and cardiogenic shock is the work of breathing. In both cases, there will be tachypnea, but in hypovolemic shock the effort of breathing is only mildly increased. However, in cardiogenic shock, the work of breathing is often significantly increased, as evidenced by grunts, nasal flaring, and the use of accessory thorax muscles. Also, since the heart is pumping ineffectively, blood remains in the pulmonary vasculature. This causes pulmonary congestion and edema, which can clinically be heard as crackles in the lungs and visualized as jugular vein distension. Pulses are often weak, capillary refill is slow, extremities are cool and cyanotic, and there may be a decrease in the level of consciousness. Obstructive shock. Obstructive shock is similar to cardiogenic shock in that the impaired heart function is the primary abnormality. In cardiogenic shock, the contractility is impaired, but in obstructive shock, the heart is prevented from contracting appropriately. Common causes of obstructive shock are cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, congenital heart malformations, and pulmonary embolism. Obstructive and cardiogenic shock is most easily distinguished by the contractility of the heart. In obstructive shock, heart contractility is normal, although pumping function is not. Cardiac tamponade is associated with muffled heart sounds since blood is present in the pericardial space. Pulsus paradoxus, for example, a drop in blood pressure on inspiration, may also be present. Tension pneumothorax is a clinical diagnosis. The trachea may have deviated away from the side of the lesion, and there are absent breath sounds over the affected side of the chest. Consider a pulmonary embolism, when the person is cyanotic and or hypotensive, experiences chest pain, and has respiratory distress without lung pathology or airway obstruction. Risk factors include obesity, hormone use, family history of abnormal clotting, and coagulation factor abnormalities. Responding to shock. The goal of shock management is to get oxygen to the tissues and to the organs. This requires having enough oxygen in the blood, getting the blood to the tissues, and keeping the blood within the vasculature. Thus, shock management is dedicated to achieving these three critical goals. In objective terms, this means returning the person to the correct blood pressure and heart rate for their age, restoring normal pulses, capillary refill and mental status along with a urine output of at least 1 milliliter/kg an hour. Shock treatment varies according to etiology. Hypovolemic shock. The primary means of responding to hypovolemic shock is to provide additional volume. For children, an isotonic crystalloid such as normal saline or lactated Ringer's is the preferred fluid for volume resuscitation. While volume repletion is somewhat straightforward in adults, great care must be taken when administering intravenous fluids to children and infants. Careful estimates should be made concerning the amount of volume lost, for example blood loss, the size of the person and the degree of deficit. Current recommendations are to administer 20 ml per kilogram of fluid as a bolus over 5 to 10 minutes and repeat as needed. In hypovolemic or hemorrhagic shock, administer 3 ml of fluid for every 1 ml of estimated blood lost, a 3-to-1 ratio. If fluid boluses do not improve the signs of hypovolemic, hemorrhagic shock, consider the administration of packed red blood cells without delay. Albumin can also be considered for additional intravenous volume for shock, trauma, and burns as a plasma expander. If fluid boluses do not improve the signs of hypovolemic, hemorrhagic shock, re-evaluation of proper diagnosis, and occult blood loss, for example into the GI tract, should be considered. The remaining interventions are aimed at restoring electrolyte imbalances, for example acid/base, glucose, etc. Distributive shock. The initial management of distributive shock is to increase intravascular volume. The intent is to provide enough volume to overcome the inappropriate redistribution of existing volume. As with hypovolemic shock, administer 20 ml per kilogram of fluid as a bolus over 5 to 10 minutes and repeat as needed. Beyond initial management, therapy is tailored to the cause of the distributive shock. Septic shock. In septic shock, aggressive fluid management is generally necessary. Broad-spectrum intravenous antibiotics are a key intervention and should be administered as soon as possible. In addition, a stress dose of hydrocortisone, especially with adrenal insufficiency, and vasopressors may be needed to support blood pressure. After fluid resuscitation, vasopressors are given if needed and according to the type of septic shock. Normotensive persons are usually given dopamine, warm shock is treated with norepinephrine, and cold shock is treated with epinephrine. Transfusing packed red blood cells to bring hemoglobin above 10 grams per deciliter treats decreased oxygen carrying capacity. As blood cultures return, focus antibiotic therapy to the particular microbe and its resistance patterns. Anaphylactic shock. Intramuscular epinephrine is the first and most important treatment for anaphylactic shock. In severe cases, a second dose of epinephrine may be needed, or intravenous administration may be required. Crystalloid fluid can be administered judiciously. Remember that in anaphylactic shock, capillary permeability may increase considerably. Thus, while it is important to support blood pressure overall, there is significant likelihood that third spacing and pulmonary edema will occur. Antihistamines and corticosteroids can also blunt the anaphylactic response. If breathing challenges arise, consider albuterol use to achieve bronchodilation. In very severe cases of anaphylactic shock, a continuous epinephrine infusion in the neonatal intensive care unit, NICU, or pediatric intensive care unit, PICU, may be required. Neurogenic shock. Neurogenic shock is clinically challenging because often there is limited ability to correct the insult. Injury to the autonomic pathways in the spinal cord results in decreased systemic vascular resistance and hypotension. An inappropriately low pulse or bradycardia is a clinical sign of neurogenic shock. Therefore, treatment is focused on fluids first, 20 milliliter per kilogram bolus, over 5 to 10 minutes, then reassess the person for a response. If hypotension does not respond to fluid resuscitation, vasopressors are needed. This resuscitation should be done in conjunction with the broader neurological evaluation and treatment plan. Cardiogenic shock. Since children in cardiogenic shock have a problem with cardiac contractility, the primary goal of therapy is to restore contractility. Unlike most other types of shock, fluid resuscitation is not a primary intervention in cardiogenic shock. Often medications to support contractility and reduce afterload are first-line treatments. In normotensive persons, this means vasodilators and diuretics both decrease intravascular volume. Contractility is supported with inotropes. Milrinone is often used to decrease peripheral vascular resistance. When additional volume is needed, fluid can be administered slowly and cautiously, 5 to 10 milliliter per kilogram over 10 to 20 minutes. A pediatric cardiologist or critical care specialist should manage persons with cardiogenic shock. Obstructive shock. Causes of obstructive shock require rapid and definitive care since they are acutely life-threatening. Cardiac tamponade requires pericardial drainage. Tension pneumothorax requires needle decompression and subsequent placement of a chest tube thoracotomy. Pediatric heart surgeons can address vascular abnormalities, and ductus arteriosus can be induced to remain open by administering prostaglandin E1 analogs. Pulmonary embolism care is mostly supportive, though trained personnel can administer fibrinolytic and anticoagulant agents. Management of these complex etiologies is beyond the scope of this handbook. Self-assessment for shock. 1. A 7-year-old child is struck by a car and found to be hypotensive. What is the most likely cause of low blood pressure? A. Anaphylactic shock. B. Hypovolemic shock. C. Cardiogenic shock. D. Obstructive shock. 2. What type of shock results in bounding peripheral pulses and a wide pulse pressure? A. Septic. B. Cardiogenic. C. Traumatic. D. Hemorrhagic. 3. You are treating a pediatric person with low blood pressure. What amount of fluid is recommended for bolus therapy? A. 100 milliliter per kilogram. B. 1 liter. Circa 5 milliliter per kilogram. D. 20 milliliter per kilogram. Answers. 1. B. Trauma is a leading cause of blood loss and hypovolemic shock. 2. A. Septic shock can result in a wide pulse pressure with low systemic resistance and normal or increased stroke volume. 3. D. Consider boluses of 20 milliliters per kilogram of isotonic crystoid, normal saline or lactated ringers. Chapter 10. Cardiac arrest. Recognizing cardiac arrest. Unlike cardiac arrest in adults, which is very common due to acute coronary syndrome, cardiac arrest in pediatrics is more commonly the consequence of respiratory failure or shock. Thus, cardiac arrest can often be avoided if respiratory failure or shock is successfully managed. Less than 10% of the time, cardiac arrest is the consequence of ventricular arrhythmia and occurs suddenly. It may be possible to identify a reversible cause of cardiac arrest and treat it quickly. The reversible causes are essentially the same in children and infants as they are in adults. Pulseless electrical activity and asystole. Pulseless electrical activity, PEA, and asystole are related cardiac rhythms in that they are both life-threatening and unshockable. Asystole is the absence of electrical or mechanical cardiac activity, and is represented by a flatline ECG. There may be subtle movement away from baseline, drifting flatline, but there is no perceptible cardiac electrical activity. Make sure that a reading of asystole is not a technical error. Ensure that the cardiac leads are connected, gain is set appropriately, and the power is on. Check two different leads to confirm. P is one of any number of ECG waveforms, even sinus rhythm, but without a detectable pulse. P may include any pulseless waveform except VF, VT, or asystole. Asystole may be preceded by an agonal rhythm. An agonal rhythm is a waveform that is roughly similar to a normal waveform, but occurs intermittently, slowly, and without a pulse. P and asystole are unshockable rhythms. Ventricular fibrillation and pulseless ventricular tachycardia. Ventricular fibrillation, VF, and pulseless ventricular tachycardia, VT, are life-threatening cardiac rhythms that result in ineffective ventricular contractions. VF is a rapid quivering of the ventricle instead of a forceful contraction. The ventricular motion of VF is not synchronized with atrial contractions. Pulseless VT occurs when the rapidly contracting ventricles are not pumping blood sufficiently to create a palpable pulse. In both VF and pulseless VT, victims are not receiving adequate perfusion. VF and pulseless VT are shockable rhythms. VF and pulseless VT are shockable rhythms. Responding to cardiac arrest. The first management step in cardiac arrest is to begin high-quality CPR. CBLS section of this handbook for details. CPR quality. Rate of 100 to 120 compressions per minute. Compression depth 1/3 diameter of chest, 1.5 inches, 4 centimeters, in infants and 2 inches, 5 centimeters, in children. Minimize interruptions. Do not overventilate. Rotate compressor every 2 minutes. If no advanced airway, 15 to 2 compression ventilation ratio. If advanced airway, 20 to 30 breaths per minute with continuous chest compressions. Shock energy. First shock, 2 joule per kilogram. Second shock, 4 joule per kilogram. Subsequent shocks, greater than or equal to 4 joules per kilogram. Maximum dose of the shock, 10 joules per kilogram or adult dose. Return of spontaneous circulation. Return of pulse and blood pressure. Spontaneous arterial pressure waves with intra-arterial monitoring. Advanced airway. Supraglottic advanced airway or ET intubation. Waveform capnography to confirm and monitor ET tube placement. Once advanced airway in place, give one breath every 2 to 3 seconds, 20 to 30 breaths per minute, drug therapy. Epinephrine IV iodose, 0.01 mg per kilogram, repeat every 3 to 5 minutes. If no IO-IV access, may give an endotracheal dose of 0.1 mg per kilogram. Amiodarone IV iodose 5 mg per kilogram bolus during cardiac arrest may repeat up to 2 times for refractory VF/pulseless VT. Reversible causes. Hypovolemia. Hypoxia. H+ acidosis, hypothermia. Hypo/hyperkalemia. Hypoglycemia. Tamponade, cardiac. Toxins. Tension pneumothorax. Thrombosis, pulmonary. Thrombosis, coronary. Trauma. Self-assessment for cardiac arrest. 1. Your team responds to a car accident where a 14-year-old is found in cardiac arrest. Which is a potentially reversible cause? A. Aortic dissection. B. Traumatic brain injury. C. Tension pneumothorax. D. Spinal cord rupture. 2. Which of the following are reversible causes of cardiac arrest? A. Hypothermia. B. Hypoxia. C. Tetanus. D. Theophylline overdose. Answers. 1. C. Remember the H's and T's when evaluating cardiac arrest individuals. Attention pneumothorax can be initially treated with needle decompression and subsequent chest tube placement. The other injuries are not reversible. 2. B. Hypoxia is a common precipitating factor for pediatric cardiac arrest scenarios. Hypothermia, toxins, trauma, and tamponade are additional causes. Chapter 11. Post-resuscitation care. If a person has a return of spontaneous circulation, ROSC, start post-resuscitation care immediately. The initial PALS process is intended to stabilize a child or an infant during a life-threatening event. Post-resuscitation care is meant to optimize ventilation and circulation, preserve organ/tissue function, and maintain recommended blood glucose levels. Below find a systematic approach followed by a post-resuscitation care algorithm to guide you in your treatment. Respiratory system. Chest X-ray to verify ET tube placement. Arterial blood gas, ABG, and correct acid/base disturbance. Pulse oximetry, continuously monitor, heart rate and rhythm, continuously monitor, and tidal CO2. If the person is intubated, maintain adequate oxygenation, saturation between 94% and 99%. Maintain adequate ventilation to achieve PCO2 between 35 to 45 millimeters of mercury unless otherwise indicated. Intubate if oxygen and other interventions do not achieve adequate oxygenation. Need to maintain a patent airway in the child with a decreased level of consciousness. Ventilation is not possible through non-invasive means, for example, continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP, control pain with analgesics and anxiety with sedatives, for example, benzodiazepines. Cardiovascular system. Arterial blood gas, ABG, and correct acid/base disturbances. Hemoglobin and hematocrit, transfuse or support as needed, heart rate and rhythm, continuously monitor, blood pressure, continuously monitor with arterial line, central venous pressure, CVP, urine output. Chest X-ray. 12-lead ECG, consider echocardiography. Maintain appropriate intravascular volume. Treat hypotension. Use vasopressors if needed and titrate blood pressure, pulse oximetry, continuously monitor, maintain adequate oxygenation, saturation between 94% and 99%, correct metabolic abnormalities, chemistry panel. Neurological system. Elevate head of bed if blood pressure can sustain cerebral perfusion. Temperature. Avoid hypothermia and treat fever aggressively. Do not rewarm hypothermic cardiac arrest victim unless hypothermia is interfering with cardiovascular function. Treat hypothermia complications as they arise. Blood glucose. Treat hypo/hyperglycemia, hypoglycemia defined as less than or equal to 60 mg per deciliter. Monitor and treat seizures. Seizure medications. Remove metabolic/toxic causes. Blood pressure, continuously monitor with arterial line, maintain cardiac output and cerebral perfusion. Normal ventilation unless temporizing due to intracranial swelling. Frequent neurological exams. Consider CT and or EEG, electroencephalogram, dilated unresponsive pupils, hypertension, bradycardia, respiratory irregularities, or apnea may indicate cerebral herniation. Renal system. Monitor urine output. Infants and small children, greater than 1 milliliter per kilogram an hour. larger children, greater than 30 milliliters an hour. Exceedingly high urine output could indicate neurological or renal problem. Diabetes insipidus, routine blood chemistries. Arterial blood gas, ABG, and correct acid/base disturbances. Urinalysis, when indicated, maintain cardiac output and renal perfusion. Consider the effect of medications on renal tissue, nephrotoxicity, consider urine output in the context of fluid resuscitation. Toxins can sometimes be removed with urgent/emergent hemodialysis when antidotes fail or are not available. Gastrointestinal system. Monitor nasogastric, NG/orogastric, OG tube for patency and residuals. Perform a thorough abdominal exam. Tense abdomen may indicate bowel perforation or hemorrhage. Consider abdominal ultrasound and/or abdominal CT. Routine blood chemistries including liver panel. Arterial blood gas, ABG, and correct acid/base disturbances. Be vigilant for bleeding into the bowel, especially after hemorrhagic shock. Hematological system. Monitor complete blood count and coagulation panel. Transfuse, as needed, correct thrombocytopenia. Fresh frozen plasma is to replenish clotting factors. Consider calcium chloride or gluconate if massive transfusion required. Correct metabolic abnormalities, chemistry panel, especially after transfusion. Self-assessment for pediatric post-resuscitation care. 1. Which of the following are useful to determine end organ perfusion? A. Urine output. B. Mental status. C. Skin color. D. All of the above. 2. You have resuscitated a critically ill child. What is the goal for oxygen saturation? A. 100%. B. 94% to 99%. C. 90% to 94%. D. Greater than 88%. Answers. 1. D. All are useful clinical tools to assess for perfusion. Inadequate perfusion results in decreased or absent urine output, confusion, and cool or mottled skin. 2. B. Optimize oxygenation and ventilation and titrate supplementary oxygen to obtain an oxygen saturation of 94% to 99%. Chapter 12. PALS Essentials. Prevention does not require advanced skills, and early intervention can positively impact an emergency situation. Keep in mind that the child and infant's family and their response are influenced by a variety of factors and coping skills. Mentally prepare for treating the child or the infant as you approach the scene. Assess the appearance, work of breathing, and skin color as you approach any child or infant. A child or infant's general appearance provides an important clue to the severity of illness. Alert and interactive children or infants are rarely seriously ill. Head bobbing is a sign of respiratory distress in infants. A normal pulse oximetry reading does not exclude respiratory distress. Infants and young children may become agitated when attempting to apply supplemental oxygen. Slowing of normal respiratory rate after a period of respiratory distress can herald respiratory arrest. Bradycardia in children is most often due to hypoxia. Sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, is the leading cause of death for infants 1 month to 1 year of age. The unexpected death of a child or infant is extremely stressful for the rescuer/provider. If a foreign body is suspected, look inside the mouth and airway before suctioning. Nasopharyngeal airways are useful for persons having a seizure. Do not blindly sweep the airway to avoid pushing a foreign body further. Pull the jaw up into the mask. Do not push the mask onto the face when using bag valve mask. Deliver breath slowly over 1 second to avoid gastric distension. Chapter 13. Additional tools. Medicode. With Medicode, you no longer will have to carry a set of expandable cards with you at all times while at work. You will never have to waste valuable time in an emergency situation searching through multiple algorithms until you find the right one. All of the algorithms are now accessible from the palm of your hand, and you will be selecting your desired algorithm by memory in no time. Choose between multiple viewing options and easily share algorithms with coworkers and friends through email and social media. To improve functionality and speed in obtaining your desired algorithm as quickly as possible in an emergency, they have been divided between BLS, ACLS, PALS, and CPR. All are accessible from the home screen. The individual algorithms included in this app are Basic Life Support, BLS, Advanced Cardiac Life Support, ACLS, Pediatric Advanced Life Support, PALS, Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation, CPR, AD, and First Aid. CERT Alert Plus. CERT Alert Plus is the perfect app to minimize a potential area of stress and distraction in your life. With CERT Alert Plus, you will have all your licenses and certifications in one place anytime you need them. We will keep track and remind you when your expiration date approaches, and we will help you with your registration whenever possible. With CERT Alert Plus, you can compile all required licenses and certifications in one location. Take photos, front and back, of certification cards and licenses for simple reference. Record all expiration dates and store them with ease. Choose when you want to be reminded of your approaching expiration dates. Send all license or certification information directly to your email. After exporting from the app, quick access to easily register for online certification and recertification courses. Chapter 14. PALS Review Questions. 1. Children have underscore metabolic rates compared to adults. A. Lower. B. Higher. C. Equal. D. Unpredictable. 2. The primary assessment includes all of the following assessments except A. Airway. B. Breathing. C. Choking. D. Exposure. 3. Which of the following is a sign of upper airway obstruction? A. Fever. B. Stridor. C. Nasal flaring. D. Itching. 4. The following is an indication of poor ventilation. A. Hypertension. B. Hyperthyroidism. C. Hypercarbia. D. None of the above. 5. The following cause sinus tachycardia except A. Metabolic stress. B. Moebius type 2 block. C. Fever. D. Acute blood loss. 6. Common causes of acute community-acquired pneumonia include which of the following? A. Streptococcus pneumonia. B. Mycoplasma pneumonia. C. Chlamydia pneumonia. D. All of the above. 7. Hypoxemia is defined as a room ESPO2 reading less than underscore in a child. A 98%. B. 94%. Circa 90%. D. 96%. 8. Common causes of upper airway obstruction include all of the following except A. Aspirated foreign body. B. Asthma. C. Allergic reactions. D. Peritonsillar abscess. 9. The following may be used in the treatment of croup. A. Dexamethasone. B. Nebulized epinephrine. C. Oxygen. D. All of the above. 10. Which statement concerning asystole is not correct? A. Asystole is a state of no myocardial contractions and no cardiac output or blood flow. B. An asystolic person has no detectable electrical activity. C. A flat line on an ECG always indicates asystole. D. Asystole is one of the rhythms associated with cardiac arrest. 11. Types of shock include all of the following except A. Anaphylactic shock, B. Hypovolemic shock, C. Cardiogenic shock, D. Hypothermic shock. 12. When providing fluid resuscitation in children, how should intravenous fluid boluses be given? A. 15 ml per kilogram bolus over 5 to 20 minutes. B. 20 ml per kilogram bolus over 5 to 20 minutes. C. 25 ml per kilogram bolus over 5 to 20 minutes. D. 30 ml per kilogram bolus over 5 to 20 minutes. 13. Effectiveness of fluid resuscitation and medication therapy should be frequently monitored by which of the following? A. Heart rate. B. Blood pressure. C. Mental status. D. All of the above. 14. Common signs and symptoms of compensated shock include A. Excessive sweating. B. Increased heart rate. C. Wide pulse pressure. D. Hypertension. 15. When should vasopressors be administered during the management of septic shock? A. When the person is responding to fluid resuscitation. B. When the person is severely hypotensive despite proper fluid management. C. Always indicated as soon as IV access is obtained. D. Vasopressors are never used for septic shock. 16. For fluid resuscitation in hypovolemic shock, give about underscore of cristoid for every underscore of blood lost. A. 1 milliliter, 2 milliliters. B. 3 milliliters, 2 milliliters. C. 3 milliliters, 1 milliliter. D. 2 milliliters, 3 milliliters. 17. Hypoglycemia is defined as underscore in infants, children, and adolescents. A. Greater than or equal to 40 milligrams per deciliter. B. Greater than or equal to 50 milligrams per deciliter. C. Less than or equal to 60 milligrams per deciliter. D. Less than or equal to 70 milligrams per deciliter. 18. The gold standard treatment for anaphylactic shock is A. Milrinone. B. Epinephrine. C. Dopamine. D. Dobutamine. 19. The preferred order of drug delivery routes are A. IV route, IO route, ET route. B. ET route, IV route, IO route. C. IO route, ET route, IV route. D. IV route, ET route, IO route. 20. Which rhythm should be shocked? A. Ventricular fibrillation. B. Pulseless ventricular tachycardia. C. Pulseless electrical activity. D. Both A and B. Answers 1. B. Higher. 2. C. Choking. 3. B. Stridor. 4. C. Hypercarbia. 5. B. Moebius type 2 block. 6. D. All of the above. 7. B. 94%. 8. B. Asthma. 9. D. All of the above. 10. C. A flat line on an ECG. 11. D. Hypothermic shock. 12. B. 20 milliliter per kilogram bolus over 5 to 20 minutes. 13. D. All of the above. 14. B. Increased heart rate. 15. B. When the person is severely hypotensive despite proper fluid management. 16. C. 3 milliliters, 1 milliliter. 17. C. Less than or equal to 60 milligrams per deciliter. 18. B. Epinephrine. 19. A. IV route, IO route, ET route. 20. D. Both A and B. Pediatric Advanced Life Support, BLS Provider Handbook. Written by Dr. Carl Disk. Narrated by Amazon Polly. Thank you for completing the Save a Life Initiative Pediatric Advanced Life Support Provider Handbook and learning how to save lives. To complete your PALS training and to become PALS certified, please visit us online at SevereLife.com to learn more. Pediatric Advanced Life Support, BLS Provider Handbook. Written by Dr. Carl Disk. Narrated by Amazon Polly. Thank you for completing the Save a Life Initiative Pediatric Advanced Life Support Provider Handbook and learning how to save lives. To complete your PALS training and to become PALS certified, please visit us online at SevereLife.com to learn more.